Thank you, Patrick. And let's ease on in with Vivaldi to this evening's Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in Cambridge, coming to you from our studios in Guider Street, a dead-end street for some, but it will lead you right to our doors. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and I invite you this evening under lamplight to attend to the theme of actors and hypocrites. How do these two categories fit together? Well, hypocrite is the Greek word for an actor, someone up on a stage who acts a part in a play. A hypocrite, in the modern sense, is someone who also acts a part. But whereas we know the actor is just taking on a part, the hypocrites do everything they can to keep us from knowing they are playing a part. Same game, different rules. I hope, as always, that attending to the words and music will bring you both delight and insight. You can listen again and hear the archived shows on the website momentsunderlamplight.com. And there's a space there for comments, or get in touch with me by email at lamplight@cambridge105.fm. So, hypocrite is the Greek word for an actor, someone who plays a role that is not that person's true self. Some people say that there is no way we can ever discover our true selves, assuming that there is such a thing as a true self, of course. All we do is play one part in life after another, the part of the obedient or rebellious teenager, or the part of the self-sacrificing hero, or the attention-getting celebrity. We can see people playing all different roles in all different areas of life and at all ages. Sometimes they switch roles rapidly in the space of a few minutes. Sometimes they play several roles at once, like some impoverished repertory company. We might say that our culture gives us these roles, and it is up to us to choose how we modify and how we play those roles. Some people don't make this choice, though, and simply go through life playing the parts in the way they expect society requires. This is the dead and dull life of the conformist, and in fact, their acting isn't very good either. The script they're working with doesn't vary, so they're safe, but boring to be with. Ray Davis has always been fascinated by the way ordinary people dream of being in the movies and go around each day pretending that they are stars. But he also turns it around to show that stars are just ordinary people. His rock opera, Soap Opera, is all about Norman, the most boring man in the world, who dreams he's a star, who takes on the role of boring Norman just to learn how ordinary people live. I'm not going to play a song from that album, but from the album Everybody's in Showbiz. That's you and me in our own humble showbiz world. The song is called Celluloid Heroes. It's a very touching meditation on the pavement of stars in Hollywood Boulevard, about the fragility of stardom. Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in showbiz. It doesn't matter who you are. And those who are successful, be always on your guard. Success walks hand in hand with failure along Hollywood Boulevard. I wish my life was a non-stop Hollywood movie show, a fantasy world of celluloid heroes and villains, because celluloid heroes never feel any pain, and celluloid heroes never really die.
Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in movies, doesn't matter. matter who you are. There are stars in every city, in every house and on every street. And if you walk down Hollywood Boulevard, their names are written in concrete. Don't step on Greta Garbo as you walk down the boulevard. She looks so weak and fragile, that's why she tried to be so hard. But they turned her into a princess, and they sat her on a throne. But she turned her back on stardom, because she wanted to be alone. You can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood. And some who suffered in vain. Rudolph Valentino looks very much alive, and he looks up ladies' dresses as they sadly pass him by. Avoid stepping on Bela Lugosi, 'cause he's liable to turn and bite. Hers was such a lonely life. If you covered him with garbage, George Saunders would still have style. And if you stamped on Mickey Rooney, he would still turn round and smile. But please don't tread on dearest Marilyn, 'cause she's not very tough. She should have been made, she was only made of flesh and blood. You can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that you hardly even heard of. Oh, people who worked and suffered and struggled for fame. Some who suffered in vain. Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in showbiz. It doesn't matter who you are. And those who are successful, be always on your guard. Success walks hand in hand with failure along Hollywood Boulevard. I wish my life was a non-stop Hollywood movie show, a fantasy world of celluloid villains and heroes. Because celluloid heroes never feel any. Walk along Hollywood. cause celluloid heroes never feel any pain. And celluloid heroes never really die.
That was the Kinks' Celluloid Heroes. Of course, there's something close to madness in this confusion of our everyday selves and the stars we dream of. If we know it's just a dream, then we have a chance of coming out sane, but many, or most, of us aren't aware of how much we are acting. Here's another song about someone who plays a part. This time he's just a kid, obviously a kid from some poor neighborhood. He has nothing going for him except his dreams of being a rap star by the name of Masterman. Through what we call dramatic irony, it's quite clear to us that this is just a kid dreaming, a kid who has to look after his baby brother, whom he casts in the role of a sidekick, Baby Jay. Me and my brother, we live alone. We got no television, got no telephone. When we walk down the street, people get out of the way. They say, here come the Master Man and Baby Jay. He thinks they're all getting out of the way because they're paying homage to his celebrity. But we can easily guess that they get out of the way because here comes that crazy kid strutting around with his baby brother in some stupid costume. Celluloid Heroes was a beautiful, poignant song, but there's something even more touching in this song by Randy Newman, Masterman and Baby Jay. Watch out, it's a bit raucous. What a pair of songs. That was Randy Newman and Master Man and Baby J. We all want to be actors because in our culture, successful actors are admired celebrities. But in many cultures, they almost have the stature of an outcast. In Shakespeare's day, the playhouse had to be across the river on the South Bank in the Red Light District, where no respectable people lived. What was so bad about actors? Well, the rigid moralists called them liars. This guy gets up on stage and says, "I am Hamlet, Prince of Denmark." "No, you're not. You are Richard Burbage, the actor. Now stop lying." Oh, how stupid. The actor is not lying. There are other words we can use, more accurate words. The actor is feigning, which means pretending, which means the actor knows and the audience knows that he is not really Hamlet. But we exercise a willing suspension of disbelief, and within the limits of the performance, we accept him in this role. If he walked into a restaurant and declared, "I am Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, give me the best table you have," well then we'd raise our eyebrows. Something wrong here for sure. You won't be surprised that the authority on this subject is William Shakespeare, whose plays are often about characters acting a part. Richard III, for instance, Shakespeare's most melodramatic villain, pretends to be a simple, kind soul, but actually, at the same time as he professes to love his brother, he is putting in train an elaborate plan to kill his brother and his nephews so he can gain the throne. We might call him a hypocrite since he does not want the other characters on stage to know that he's just playing at being a nice guy. But the interesting thing is that he tells us, the audience, everything he's doing. From the very first speech of the play, he delights in showing us the way he is adopting various roles in order to gain his own ends. And we are flattered and find ourselves on his side. As long as Richard III knows he's acting a part and reveals himself to us, playing the actor, the scriptwriter, and the director, then his actions succeed. But once he becomes king, he forgets about us. In fact, he forgets about acting altogether and just fights to keep power. And losing the strength he had as a conscious actor, he falls. In Twelfth Night, Viola, surely Shakespeare's finest woman, has to act the part of a boy in order to stay safe in a strange land. She gets a job as a courtier with the Duke, but she falls in love with him and yet cannot reveal herself as a woman. And taking messages to Olivia, whom the Duke loves, she catches Olivia's eye, and Olivia falls in love with Viola, who, of course, she thinks is a man. "What will become of this?" Viola asks herself. Some of us would go crazy with anxiety, or take a false step and ruin everything. But Viola is a true actor and knows she has to play her part well. So she shrugs her shoulders and, I think, should smile ruefully as she says, "O time, thou must untangle this, not I. It is too hard a knot for me to untie." The next time you're reading or seeing a Shakespeare play, keep an eye out for those characters who know they are playing a part and watch what they do. The only way to succeed in what you want to do in the world of Shakespeare is to act a role and know you are acting a role. By the way, A Midsummer Night's Dream is coming to the Cambridge Arts Theatre this coming week, the last week of March. Go see it if you can. That play includes the performance of Pyramus and Thisbe by the amateur mechanicals, who know they are acting but don't give their audience credit for knowing it's only a play. Suppose they worry. Suppose the ladies should be frightened by seeing a lion on the stage. Well, that's okay, because Snug the Joiner, who plays the part of the lion, gets up and takes off his mask and, spoiling the whole illusion of the stage, reassures the audience that he's only an actor, not a real lion. Now, that's very kind of him, but actually, the whole framework of the theater tells us there are no real lions, only actors. We know we're safe. Sometimes, though, we're asked to play boring, subsidiary parts, and then it becomes hard to keep up. But, well, if our money depends on playing the part, then we just become the great pretender and play the part. as the singer tells his wayward piano session man, who'd rather play jazz than rock and roll backup, "I play the game and you'd better play it too, or we're getting a new piano man."
Oh yes, I'm the great pretender.
Well, man, I just play a little ooh-baba-doo, like ooh-ba-ba, ooh-ba-ba-ba. See, I think it's a mistake on my part. I got the same chord over and over, like a clink, 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 clink.
That's
clink.
Right! That's right!
You want me to play the same thing all through the song?
You catch on fast!
Wow.
My need is such, I pretend too much. I'm lonely, but no one can tell.
Man, you scared me. Don't do that.
Oh, yes. I'm the great pretender. Adrift in a world of my own. Watch it. That's better. I'll play the game. And you'd better play it too. Or we're getting a new piano man.
That's all right with me.
To read is this feeling of make. Believe to reel when I feel what my heart can't conceal. Oh, yes, I am the great pretender. Just laughing and gay like a clown.
My hand is falling off, man.
I seem to be what I'm not, you see. I'm wearing my heart like a crown.
Oh, what a drag.
Pretending that you're still around. But just a moment! Just a moment, please!
I thought you were through, man.
No, no!
I don't want to play that lick no more, man. I come from a different school, like Shearing, Errol Garner style. Dig, man.
That's not going to sell the records!
Man, don't bug me. I don't want to play that cling, cling, cling jazz.
You play that cling, cling, cling jazz, or you won't get paid tonight. Well, all right. To reel is this feeling of make-believe. To reel when I feel what my heart can't conceal. Oh, yes, I'm great. You see how lovely that turned out now? That's the darling part. Appreciate it. I seem slow down. I seem retard.
Don't stop me now, man. I got to where I like it.
Stop it. Stop it, I say. I'm getting out of here. He ruined the ending. One of the loveliest parts in the whole. Peace.
The whole piece.
That was a little silliness from Stan Freberg. One can have too much of this, but in a small dose it works fine. And also it shows us some of the real difficulties of having our roles imposed on us, especially by directors who are not all that clever. I've recently been taking a class through the novel Descent into Hell by Charles Williams, in which we find an interesting distinction made between elocution and poetry. Elocution, as Williams is using the term, involves taking on a role, playing a part, going through the right or appropriate actions. There's nothing wrong with this. It's what we've been talking about in playing the necessary roles in our lives. But this elocution is not the whole story. It goes only so far. It lacks the true spirit of a thing, which is what Williams calls poetry. When we become too conscious of the role we're playing, there's too much elocution, not enough poetry, and we need to redress the balance. We do that by not attending so much to the part we're playing, but to what we're doing. We open up to the spirit of the role itself and submit ourselves to it. The way to do this, Williams says, is to perform with clarity, speed, courage, humility. We're clear about what lies before us to do. We do not linger over it for effect. We exercise the courage and humility to do the job without thinking too much about the dangers or about ourselves. Only in this way will we be able to perform our parts with any real feeling. Elocution requires skillful ego, but poetry in this sense requires us to put the ego aside. Think, for example, of the person who makes you a meal, following the recipes perfectly and laying the table just the way some maven in the magazines says one should, and yet the meal lacks something. That lightness of touch, which is the spirit of good hospitality, where is it? Not everyone can perceive the absence of spirit. It takes some practice to be open to spirit or to its absence. But once we know what the spirit can do, we are always aware of when it is present or not. And then there's that famous, though probably apocryphal, story we used to hear at Amherst College about the student who received an essay back that had the comment, "Perfect, A minus." Yes, too much elocution, not enough poetry. There's something higher than mere perfection. There are lots of stories of classical musicians, for instance, who play perfectly, deft and note perfect. But there's no spirit to what they're doing. They're paying too much attention to how they're doing it rather than to what the music itself says. Here's someone who is elegant, but also poetic. We've heard Jack Glatzer's violin before on Evening Under Lamplight, and here he is again with the 16th Caprice of Paganini. Jack spends 6 hours a day practicing, focusing perhaps on elocution, but I suspect he's communing with the spirit of the music. You can tell by the sparkling stillness that emanates from the man and his music, even when his bow and fingers are moving furiously. Can you attend closely to this? And here's Jack Glatzer speaking about the Caprice we've just heard. Attend to how he speaks so clearly about the technique involved here, but all in the service of the spirit of the piece, the madness and the wild animal intensity and the spirit of Paganini himself, which the performer of the music owes it to us to bring alive.
I think the 16th Caprice gives us a vision of Paganini's unbalanced personality. At times, you almost feel that he's close to insanity. And this is nothing new, that a great artist is on the brink. The intensity of this caprice is almost impossible to maintain. You feel that the bow and the violin will just split from the stress. You feel that an audience will become too breathless from hearing it. And you feel that you yourself, the violinist, can hardly manage to play until the end. So fierce is the intensity. Because Paganini adds to velocity very, very quick changes from the lowest to the highest notes, thus the bow must be used in a very vertical way, but at ridiculously fast speeds. And the fingers have to correspond, of course, to this great surging intense demand. The Tatler wrote that Paganini's violin is like a wild animal which he is endeavoring to quiet in his bosom and which he occasionally fiend-like lashes with his bow. And Paganini spoke of the electricity I experience in producing my magical music and which does me infinite harm. He knew that he had this element, and he could pick it up even when he felt very depressed and even physically weak. The music gave him that electricity, and after a concert, though, he shook from the violence of the experience. And the violence we can even see in the manuscript, because it looks like the pen starts at the first note and doesn't stop until the very end. It goes on with an insane frenzy, as does the sound of this 16th Caprice.
There we are. That was Jack Galazzo. We don't need that noise yet. Thank you. That was Jack Galazzo explaining the spirit of the Paganini Caprice we just heard. And this is Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in Cambridge, and I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, drawing your attention to actors and hypocrites. We've talked about actors and about taking on parts with eloquence and with poetry, and now it's time to attend to the hypocrites, and that means it's time to go to hell, or more precisely to the Inferno of Dante Alighieri, where we will find the most helpful mythic vision of hypocrisy. Remember our definition of hypocrisy as playing a part, pretending to be someone other than your true self, and doing all you can to keep others from recognizing that you are playing this part. But first, some background. Dante's vision of hell can be understood on many levels, but what interests me the most, and is most relevant to us here, is the sense in which his hell provides us a mirror for the sickness in our own souls, a sickness that we have brought upon ourselves by choosing ourself over the larger community, and that includes the community of the City of God. Thus, the poem is not a depiction of what will happen to us after we die. It's not a literal report. It's not even about divine punishment, but about the pain and suffering we place upon ourselves at any moment in our lives by not choosing light and compassion. Thus, we look at the suffering of the hypocrites not as a warning of what will happen to us if we act hypocritically, but as a poetic image or metaphor of what is happening to us right now in the moment of our hypocrisy. Let's see if I can explain this further. Of the three major divisions of sins in the Inferno, excess, violence, and fraud, hypocrisy comes under the third or worst division. Hypocrisy is a form of fraud, and thus it destroys the community by breaking down our trust in other people. The hypocrites are found in a section of hell in which there are 10 trenches circling for miles around the funnel-like landscape of hell. Dante and his guide Virgil find the hypocrites in a trench just after the barrators, that is, just after the people who have abused public office for their own profit. Know anyone like that today? At this point, they are escaping from some hideous demons, and Virgil holds Dante tightly as they slide down the embankment into this pit, the only time they stand on the same level as the fraudsters they're looking at. As though Dante is saying that we need to stand eye to eye with a hypocrite to see what's really going on. Virgil stands for our reason, and Dante says that as they slide down the embankment, Virgil holds Dante like a mother grabbing her child to rescue it from a burning house, not even stopping to put on any clothes herself. Our reason has to be naked, unclothed, that is, not putting on any rolls, in order to protect us from the fraud of hypocrisy. And what do they see in this pit? They see una gente dipinta, a people painted bright, not wearing makeup necessarily, though that would work as a symbol of hypocrisy, putting on a false face, but Dante can't see their faces, which are hidden by large hoods. Hypocrites keep their faces hidden, after all. They're wearing gorgeous cloaks, golden, and these are probably also painted or colored in various ways. Like the souls in many of the other circles, these souls spend eternity walking in a huge circle, endlessly going round and round, an image of what it's like to live for the self. We get nowhere, just round and round ourselves. But these souls are moving very slowly. We have to picture something like a slow motion movement, almost comical if it weren't for all the painful groans coming from them. Piangendo, e nel sembiante stanco, e vinta. Weeping, worn down and seemingly defeated, as Robin Kirkpatrick translates it in his Penguin edition. What slows them down? What makes them groan and look defeated? Those cloaks, which look so gorgeous on the outside, are actually made of lead and weigh them down so heavily that they can hardly move. And yet they must keep moving. Oh, in eterno faticoso manto, Dante exclaims, what labor to eternity to wear such dress. That was a timely interruption. I thought we had enough talking and time for a little break. From the Beatles, Carry That Weight. Odd to hear that track out of the context of that dynamic second side of Abbey Road. But back to those hypocrites. The connection of those gilded leaden cloaks to the practice of hypocrisy seems clear enough. A fine outside hiding what is inside. Isn't that hypocrisy? But what else does the image tell us? In what ways does hypocrisy act like a leaden weight upon our shoulders and slow us down, yet impel us to keep moving round and round? Let's think of an example. Suppose I'm at a dinner party where everyone is sitting around discussing the latest art exhibition. You know, that kind of scene. Only I don't really know about art, and I certainly haven't bothered to go to the exhibition and have only skimmed the reviews. But I put on a false front. I act the part of someone who knows about art, so that I'll be accepted in this present crowd and they'll like me. This is hypocrisy, isn't it? I don't have the courage to show what I'm really like or just to keep quiet until the conversation changes to something I may be able to speak about honestly. I know how to put on this false front. I know how to act all pretentious and speak the lingo of art connoisseurs. I just don't know what I'm talking about. By the way, this is what we technically call bullshit. Talking proficiently about something I don't actually know about. All right, if I'm a good hypocrite, then I'll pull off this act and no one catches on. Fine. They like me now, even admire me, even respect me, who knows? I'm the golden boy, painted in glowing colors. But what happens next time? I'm expected to be equally knowledgeable every time I see these people, and perhaps they invite me to receptions, especially because of my expertise in this subject. Now, maybe all this exposure to the art world will transform me, and maybe I'll begin to learn more about that art and begin to like it. And after a while, I'm no longer a hypocrite. I'm a genuine admirer of the art. I'm free from hell, thanks be to God. But if I go on not caring about the art, yet having to act like an expert, well, isn't this going to weigh a little heavily on me? I have to keep going, yet it's a burden painful to bear. Can I get out of it? Probably not. These are important people, and if I break away from them, I may never get a foothold in these influential circles again. Round and round I carry this heavy leaden weight, which everyone else sees as a beautifully painted golden cloak. And gradually my true self decays under this weight, and I'm left with only the weight and the compulsion to keep going. Dante compares the gilded leaden cloaks to the cloaks that the Emperor Frederick II used as punishment for traitors. A leaden sheet would be placed around the traitor and then set to melt over a fire. No detail is irrelevant in Dante. No detail is there just for effect. We have here an image of the cloak melting onto the person, in essence, merging with that person. In the same way, the hypocrite's false self, the gilded cloak, merges with the person's true self, so the person can no longer discern which is the true self and which the false self. This is the image of long-standing hypocrisy. Amazing what can be revealed if we play long enough with any line in Dante's poem. Perhaps one of the most notorious hypocrites in literature is Dr. Henry Jekyll. People usually think of Mr. Hyde as the villain of the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but I'm not so sure that's so. Hyde does evil things, that's true, and he is motivated purely by self-interest, but the real evil in the story was inside Jekyll, who, he tells us, engaged in a profound duplicity of life by indulging his impatient gaiety of disposition, living the wild life, and yet also striving to preserve the dignity of a respectable Victorian doctor by wearing a more than commonly grave countenance before the public. Though so profound a double dealer, he says, I was in no sense a hypocrite. Both sides of me were in dead earnest. I was no more myself when I laid aside restraint and plunged in shame than when I laboured in the eye of day at the furtherance of knowledge or the relief of sorrow or suffering. Jekyll may claim he wasn't a hypocrite because both roles he acted were true to himself, but the hypocrisy arises from hiding part of himself behind the mask of the other part. Stevenson was quite clear that the real evil in the book was not Hyde's, but Jekyll's. Hyde, he said, was a mere voluptuary. There's no harm in a voluptuary, and none, with my hand on my heart and in the sight of God, none, no harm whatever in what prurient fools call immorality. The harm was in Jekyll, because he was a hypocrite, not because he was fond of women. He says so himself, but people are so filled full of folly and inverted lust that they can think of nothing but sexuality. The hypocrite let out the beast Hyde, who is no more sexual than another, but who is the essence of cruelty and malice and selfishness and cowardice, and these are the diabolic in man, not this poor wish to have a woman that they make such a cry about. Hyde, then, may be the essence of cruelty and malice and selfishness and cowardice, but the hypocrisy of Jekyll is perhaps worse. And round he goes. First he's Jekyll, then he becomes Hyde for a night of pleasure, then back to Jekyll to resume his respectable life, then back to Hyde and back to Jekyll, and then, in a frightening moment, the cycle takes over his life and he becomes Hyde without even drinking the potion, and then back to Jekyll and then to Hyde, until finally the two identities merge, Hyde lying dead in Jekyll's room, wearing Jekyll's clothes, crushed by the weight of trying to keep these two identities separate. And what happens, by the way, to the people who are taken in by our hypocrisy, whom we have defrauded? Here, waiting to play for us next, is Bob Dylan with one of his fiercest songs, directed against a man who has the nerve to say he is my friend, but I know better. You just want to be on the side that's winning. That is, you are serving your ego, not the truth. And he's not even a good actor. If you're so hurt, why then don't you show it? I know the reason you talk behind my back. I used to be among the crowd you're in with. I used to go to those same dinner parties you hang out now. I know the kind of insincere talk that goes on in such places. You say, how are you? Good luck, but you don't mean it. When you know, as well as me, you'd rather see me paralyzed. Why don't you just come out once and scream it? At least that would be truthful and better than this stinking hypocrisy. This hypocrite, Dylan says, is one who tries to hide what he don't know to begin with. And here's the futility and emptiness of hypocrisy. You pretend to be someone else and hide who you really are, but you are at the same time hiding from yourself the knowledge of who you really are. So although you're frantically trying to hide your real self, you no longer even know what the real self is. How can you ever get to know yourself if you're pretending to be someone else? It's all a furious race to escape from yourself, poor thing. And not a very effective race, moving in slow motion, weighted down with lead, going in circles. And then the final put down, one of Dylan's finest, which takes on a new light in the context of Dante. I wish that for just one time you could stand inside my shoes, and just for that one moment I could be you. Yes, I wish that for just one time you could stand inside my shoes, you'd know what a drag it is to see you. You'd know what a drag it is to see you. Not only he, the hypocrite, is weighted down by that leaden cloak, but all the rest of us too, dragged down by that false front. Let's hear the song. Attend to the energy with which Dylan knocks him down.
So hurt, why then don't you show it? You say you've lost your faith, but that's not where it's at. You have no faith to lose, and you know it. Say, how are you? Good luck, but you don't mean it. When you know as well as me, you'd rather see me paralyzed. Why don't you just come out once and scream it? No, I do not feel that good when I see the heartbreaks you embrace. If I was a master, satisfied with your position and your place. Don't you understand? It's not my problem. I wish that for just one time you could stand inside my shoes. And just for that one moment I could be you. Yes, I wish that for just one time you could stand inside my shoes.
That was Dylan's Positively, 4th Street, showing the effects of one man's hypocrisy upon another. But let's return to Dante and the circle of the hypocrites. Suddenly, Dante and Virgil stop in amazement. What's that on the ground in front of them? Or rather, who is that on the ground in front of them? It's a figure crucified on the ground, legs pinned with one stake and each arm staked outwards. And as he lies there, all of these hypocrites with their heavy weight step on him as they pass. This, Dante learns, is Caiaphas, the high priest who assented to Jesus' death, saying that it was expedient that one man should die for the people, even though he knew that this one man was innocent. I'm always astounded at Dante's perception that expediency belongs in the circle of hypocrisy. In fact, the exemplar of expediency is even lower than the hypocrites and is stomped on by the hypocrites, as though the person who goes for expediency places himself under the foot of the hypocrites. Any false face can impress him. What is expediency, and what's wrong with it? Expediency is choosing to follow a course of action that you know is wrong in principle, but that you carry out for its short-term practical benefits. I remember traveling on a train once with the headmaster of a public school who said to me that he'd just come from a meeting with the trustees where he had to assent to buying a new expensive lawnmower that would save money because it would allow them to get rid of 2 of the full-time gardeners. He knew this was wrong, but what could he do? The short-term saving in money was all that the trustees could consider. Who was the expedient hypocrite then, he or the trustees? The person to go to for wisdom about expediency is Henry David Thoreau. Thoreau admits that a government is mostly concerned with what is expedient, that is, what works best in the present circumstances. If there's a trade dispute, for instance, then the government might come in and try to resolve it in a way that satisfies both parties. But Thoreau says there are times when higher issues are at stake, when it becomes a matter of principle to be decided by our conscience, that voice of deep truth within us. These are what he calls those cases to which the rule of expediency does not apply, in which a people, as well as an individual, must do justice cost what it may. If I have unjustly wrested a plank from a drowning man, I must restore it to him, though I drown myself. Thoreau was speaking in the context of an unjust war waged by America against Mexico, a war started by the stronger neighbor in order to acquire more land that had once been Mexico's, in order to extend the slave states further west. In other words, the war was an act of bullying, and it was carried out in order to strengthen the practice of slavery. It was clearly wrong, and Thoreau refused to pay his tax, 1 penny, which would go to supporting this war. This was the most direct way Thoreau could strike back at an unjust government policy. He broke the law. Others would say that the thing to do would be to pay the taxes in order to stay on the safe side of the law, but then try to fix things in a peaceable way later. No, says Thoreau, the injustice is too severe. It is hypocrisy to continue to be on good terms with the government just to keep yourself safe. An honest man breaking the law and being put into prison would lead to all other honest people taking a stand. Under a government which imprisons any unjustly, Thoreau says, the true place for a just man is also a prison. This is what we call civil disobedience. Well, how are we going to end our discussion this evening under lamplight? Let's try this. How about Leonard Cohen's Be For Real? Be For Real. From his album, The Future. That will shift us from the hypocritical false front to some inner honesty. He's flexible, he says, and that's what a hypocrite is not. I don't give a damn about the truth, he says, except for the naked truth. That's a tough guy line, but at least we're wearing no gilded cloaks when we are for real. That's what the naked truth is all about. So with Leonard Cohen, we'll say good night from Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, Cambridge's community radio. It's no secret that I'm playing the role of RLA, and no secret that I'm looking forward to seeing you next time. Good night.
Are you back in my life to stay? Or is it just for the day? You're gonna need me. If it's a thrill you're looking for, honey, I'm flexible. See?